Now, moving on to stories that are very, very important, and different aspects of them crop up over and over and over again. I'm talking about your health and well-being. So we've so many crises in healthcare now. The issue goes back to one thing, among others: we don't have enough doctors. So I'm now going to talk to somebody who has a thorough understanding of the domain of doctors, and we're also going to ask why so many Irish-trained doctors are leaving the country and whether all the doctors that replace them are trained to the same standard. This is Dr. Rita Doyle, who works as a GP and is president of the Medical Council, which is the regulating body for medical doctors in Ireland. Not only president of the council, also practicing GP. Busy woman.
Yeah, busy woman. I've always been a busy woman. I've run my practice. I have five children. So if you manage to juggle that, I'm now juggling general practice and the medical council.
Which is more difficult, I ask myself. I'll start first of all with the lack of GPs, because it came up on the programme while I was away. That 600 to 700, I beg your pardon, GPs are due to retire in the next year. That's out of 3,000. That's a huge proportion.
It's a huge proportion, and I come into that realm. I'm certainly in the winter of my career. And there's been a shortage of GPs for probably the last 5-7 years. And a lot of our young graduates are going abroad because better conditions, not necessarily for better money, but better work-life balance than is currently here. And of course, the GP band is now stretched. And, you know, if you stretch elastic too far, it'll eventually break.
It's hard to get a GP now, isn't it?
It's very hard to get a GP. I feel sorry for patients in this regard. But there's only a limited amount of safe work you can do. And I've closed my list about a year ago. And when you close your list, and when people who have medical cards who can't get a GP, patients are assigned to you. So even closing your list doesn't mean that your list is closed. Okay. So,
and how many would you have on your list?
My medical card list is nigh on 1,100. And when that's weighted for age, because where I work, there's a large elderly population, weighted for age, it comes up to 1,600. My private list, you never know exactly how big that is, but it's about 2,500.
Right.
So the guts of 4,000, you
could say. Yeah. And can people knock the door and walk in, or do they have to make appointments?
I've always worked an appointment system from the day I started. Yeah.
That's walking in the door seems to have gone out with the button boots, has it?
It's gone out, except some doctors who are so busy, they run an emergency clinic on and you just walk in and sit and wait till you're seen.
Right, because emergencies kind of don't always wait till next week.
Absolutely.
And that could be the problem with one of the problems with A&E. In terms of those doctors are leaving the medical register, the ones that are going away, this is all interlinked: GPs, consultants, specialists. You give me the big picture.
Okay, I suppose the big picture is this, that we train more doctors in this country than any other country in the OECD. More doctors, we train them. This is at undergraduate level. But we export more doctors than any other country in the OECD. Now, some of the doctors that we train would naturally go back home from Malaysia and would do their internship there. And some of the North Americans would have an agreement, and the Canadians. But we also export our own. Sometimes, you see, we're limited to the number of interns that we can qualify in this country. There's only 733 intern places.
Why?
Because that's what the Fotrel report in 2006 stated, and that has to change, because it's very unfair to take the money off international graduates and not offer them an internship. I would see that as being morally unjust.
Okay? Right, yeah.
So that's what it is, but that needs to change. And the NDTP, the National Doctor Training Planning in the HSE, are looking at this as well. So we do need to train more interns. But if you talk to the interns now, they're very young at the moment. They're only 3 weeks, 4 weeks in post at the moment. But at the end of, they're already planning to leave, which is
Why?
Very sad. Part of it is because lack there. I suppose somebody described me as the interns do everything that nobody else will do. So it's not core
Explain,
work.
First of all, to the listeners, what is an intern?
Okay. You spend, depending on which school you're in and what, you spend 4 or 5 years in university. Okay. So when you finished all your undergraduate training and you get your MB, BCH, whatever degrees you're getting, and you're now officially entitled to be called doctor, your first post is as an intern, but that is actually part of your training. And the intern posts are educationally managed by the medical schools as opposed to the postgraduate schools. So you have to have completed your internship.
How long does that take?
It takes a year.
1 year. And what's life like for an intern?
It's chaotic, absolutely chaotic. They carry their bleeps, they're interrupted nonstop. I was privileged to the very first gathering of interns happened this year. Okay, the really excellent girl in the HSE, Dr. Ghazi Ofaya, who's the clinical lead for intern education, and she set this up in the Aviva, and I was privileged to go and talk to them in 3 weeks ago before they actually started. And I was pleading with them to stay with us. But I was also pleading that we've got a lot of research amongst our armamentarium, and it shows that bullying within the hospital system is high, okay, and we get it, and it's increased from 34% to 40%, whether that's an increase in reporting or whether it's a real increase. So I said to them, I want you, the class of 2019, to be the difference, not to tolerate it.
Not
to tolerate bullying. And if they were bullying, to know exactly which pathways within the institution that they're working on. And if they got no joy, I would listen to them, and they can report to me formally or informally.
How does this bullying manifest itself? Because you hear about it a lot.
Yes.
At all levels in the medical world.
Yeah, I suppose if you go back, medicine was always a hierarchical profession, and there was very little consideration that people are equal. And of course, people are equal. Mm-hmm. I have no doubt about that.
No, except not if you're dealing with Mr. Rees-Mogg. That's
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Well, I saw that number. They're going back to imperial measures. So we'll be having patients weighed in stones instead of kilos in future when they come back from the UK. But that's just an aside. Medicine has always been a hierarchical institution. Yeah. And I would think my view on this would be that this medical council has a zero tolerance for bullying.
No, that's not the question that I asked you. Okay. I don't for a moment suspect that you wouldn't intend to do that. But how do you block it, and how does it happen? And as you say, the intern does what nobody else will do.
That's right.
What do they do? What is that?
Well,
is that getting barked at by somebody, or is it getting hounded by patients?
It can be. And I certainly heard a consultant say to me not that long ago, well, when they won't do such and such, and he threw his hands up in there, and then they say, and they don't like how I talk to them. And I said, well, I wouldn't like how you talk to him, because I just heard what he had said, using bad language, that sort of thing. That's not right to talk to anybody. These are the future of our medicine. These young interns will be the doctors for the consultants, okay, when they get sick. So we need, as I said, they are the jewel in our crown. We need to polish that, not tarnish it.
Are you laying it at the consultant's door?
No. If you look at the analysis of the bullying,
yeah,
about 60% of it is from doctors. Now, we haven't got that divided into whether it's consultants or senior registrars or fellow interns, and about 30% by nurses and midwives. And the remainder would be patients and possibly GPs bullying a young doctor on the phone or whatever. Harassing might be a better word.
Yeah. And so they're going to, many of them are going to leave.
Yes.
Now, for everybody listening to this programme, their tax dollars or euros have paid for a very fine education for these people. Absolutely. And wonderful that it should be so. Do you not think there should be a quid pro quo?
I actually don't. I think there would be a quid pro quo if the conditions here were equal. Okay, I think if you ask any of these young doctors, they want to stay here. And if you look at even our most recent research, your training counts, more of them want to stay here, but they can't tolerate the conditions that are.
What hours are they working now?
They are supposed to be working the European Working Time Directive. That is the law. We've written to the HSE. We've many, many issues about doctors being made to work far longer hours. There are not, you know this, Marion, there are not enough doctors in our system at every level, at consultant level, at junior level, at GP level, and there aren't enough nurses either. I know we've a lot of nurses, but they're not deployed in the most appropriate fashion.
Whose failure is this? I mean, could you not persuade those people and encourage them and I suppose shame them into saying, look, people of much less means than you have paid their taxes to educate you and we will need you and you owe us something.
And traditionally, Irish doctors did go abroad. They would maybe complete their training here. They would go abroad to get the fellowship or the extra polish and they'd come back with new ideas. But now they don't come back. Interestingly, about 6 months ago, I was away on business and I ended up sitting between the New Zealand chair of their medical council and the Australian, okay? And I said to the New Zealand girl, what are you doing stealing all our doctors? And she said, because they're the best trained doctors in the world. And she said, not alone are we stealing them, we're trying to keep them.
So then how do you replace them? Because just a casual walk through a hospital now, there are people from all over the world. Are you confident that the doctors that are coming in have as good a training and an education as the ones that we're educating and shipping out?
Well, the Medical Council is the custodian of the register. Okay,
yeah.
So we assess the qualifications and some countries we have reciprocity with, but the qualifications are assessed. But you still may find that the doctors that come in don't have the same experience. So that's up to the HSE, who is the employer, to make sure that the doctors they're employing are appropriate for the job. Now, just to say that our health service would fall apart without these doctors. They are incredible. They're coming from countries who may need them more than we need them.
Yeah.
But one of the real issues...
Which is we're ripping off their skills as well, to speak.
But
yeah.
One of the real issues has been that they were ineligible to train here. They would be a qualified doctor, completed their internship, and they'd come and work here, and they would not be eligible to get on a training scheme. Now, the legislation is changing as far as that's concerned. There's a new bill actually in the Dáil at the moment called the Regulated Professions Health and Social Care Bill. And we hope that will be due out before Christmas. And then these doctors at least will be able to train to the level of our own doctors.
One third of the doctors currently working here have been trained outside the EU.
Yeah.
Countries including Egypt, Sudan, Pakistan, Romania and the United Kingdom cumulatively contributed more new entrants to the Irish Register of Medical Practitioners than Ireland did. Why are we training doctors at all?
That's right. And we were not offering them training. Like, some of these doctors are superb, Marion, okay?
Yeah, of course.
And if they're the ones who are here, they deserve to get the same as our own graduates do insofar as access to training, because if they get trained up, then they are eligible for consultancy. But a lot of them are at a permanent pace with no postgraduate qualifications.
Now, there is one. I'm not going to go through the list of names because it would sound inappropriate, so to speak. But... there was the doctor who was on, he was on the radio actually, misidentified an X-ray image of an ankle as being one of an elbow. And it went on to say 30 alleged examples of professional misconduct and displaying lack of professional knowledge, bordering on disgraceful and dishonourable, came from Frank Beattie, who was appeared on behalf of the Medical Council Chief Executive Officer. That put the fear of God in people.
That would put the fear of God in you. But remember, we only hear about the really serious ones, okay? And if you look at the number of doctors in the system, there's nigh on 23,000 doctors. And in 2018, we had 396 complaints, okay? And of that 396, only 29 went on to fitness to practice. So there was no prima facie case against the other doctors, okay? And actually, if you analysed the doctors who went to fitness to practice and were subsequently struck off, there were only five struck off in 2018. And three of these were EU qualification, one Ireland and one outside the EU. So it's not necessarily that they're the worst in the system.
None of us want to, but we absolutely have to realise that everybody at some stage in their life, in their professional life, in their personal life, whatever, is going to make a mistake. However, when it is a doctor, it impinges so much more if it's your child, your parent, your
or
whatever. And the other side of that coin is that doctors and indeed consultants feel that you guys are arrogant and that you send them out circulars and you do this and that you're like an arrogant police force.
Yeah, that has been thrown at us. I think if I were to tell you this, that our prime responsibility is the safety of patients, but we have huge responsibility in supporting doctors to give them the means to.
Well, they don't feel that, because if they're going through your system, it can go on apparently for a very long time and cause incredible stress and worry for the doctor.
Absolutely. I accept all of that. I mean, I think even getting a letter from the medical council is enough to give a doctor a sleepless night.
Yeah.
I absolutely accept all of that. And it is a very legalistic process, okay? But we have a huge remit with regard to education, literally from undergraduate to postgraduate, cradle to grave. And we can't stop complaints coming in. The public make complaints.
And the patient is the centre of your interest.
The patient is the centre of our interest. Now, again, attached to that new legislation that's going through the Dáil, that could make a subtle but important change for doctors, because currently the law, the act under which we act, the 2007 Medical Practitioners Act, currently that says that every complaint must be opened and every complaint must be investigated. So what happens now is the complaint comes in and it goes straight to the Preliminary Proceedings Committee, or the PPC, who have to investigate it. That in itself takes time. We're doing some work, particularly with the ICGP, the Irish College of General Practitioners, and the medical indemnifiers, to start a local complaints process. Okay, the new legislation says that, or will say, hopefully, that the CEO may look at the complaints and decide that this is not relevant. So what we're hoping will be that, you know, the smaller complaints, the CEO will be able to say, have you processed this locally? Because that's where it should be processed.
Right.
And if you haven't, go back and process it locally and come back to us if you don't get joy. So it will be, that will be good for doctors and it will be good for patients.
Communications is such an important thing. And in the Scally report, it would raise the hair on your head to realise the disgraceful fashion in which some of the women were or were not communicated with. Disclosure. Apologies. Where do you stand on that?
All right. Communications is just probably the most vital part of medical work. GPs are good communicators. They have to be. You wouldn't survive a wet day in general practice if you weren't a good communicator. But you have to continuously improve your communications. You have to improve all the way through. As a statutory body, we are going to make communications a mandatory part of continual professional development in each five-year cycle. There will have to be a certain percentage of it addressed to communications. The HSE are running a good initiative with a retired surgeon, Peter Gillen, and Winnie Ryan, and they're running it through the HSE, but they're having great difficulty in getting doctors to pick up on the course. Okay, now maybe that they think they're too busy, or it may be that
they
there isn't appropriate.
That they don't need improvement.
You may be right about that, okay? And sometimes it may be a fear that their younger peers will communicate better than them.
Can you make that mandatory?
They will have to do a certain percentage of their, you know, that continuing professional development is mandatory.
Right.
And we have 5-year cycles. So we're making a portion of that to be mandatory communication training.
Even for already qualified?
Absolutely. Marion, I was talking to your researcher. I used to be a tutor in medical education when I was younger. Okay. And so that meant you organise continuing education for your own GPs, but in small groups. Okay. So we took to trainees do video consultations when in general practice. So is that you video with the patient's consent, and then as a trainer, I would have analysed it. When I was doing this with my colleagues, it was fascinating. 20 years down the road, you're 20 years qualified and you're watching a professional on a video. When I did my own video, I can tell you that was an eye-opener. When I first looked at it, you nearly want to lock all the doors before you look at a video of yourself consulting. I discovered that I was picking my teeth with paper clips. I had no idea I was doing that. They're banned off my desk now. But if you don't start looking at how you communicate, there are a whole lot of different things.
Right.
Ways. So communications, you know, breaking bad news is not easy, but there are better ways to do it. So training and specific skills all the way through your profession
and
is really important.
Disclosure?
Open disclosure. Patients want to know the truth. I think we live in a litigious society doctors are afraid sometimes. I had a patient recently who, for want of a better word, got an infection, healthcare acquired infection.
Yeah.
And he said when all was done, he said to his consultant, well, what happened? And the consultant said to him, well, you might sue me. And he said, I don't have no interest in suing you. I just want to know what happened and I want to know where the learning is. And that's what patients want.
OK, I want to move on because I have a whole heap of things I want to go over with you. One was a case that came up in court. And where it emerged that 450 consultant posts in the country are vacant. Meanwhile,
that figure has gone up to 519 as of the end
right,
of this
last month. At the time, it was 134 doctors on the general register of the Medical Council who have not trained as consultants are employed as consultants. And I have to tell you that Mr. Justice Peter Kelly, President of the High Court, was not one bit happy with that and just said it was outrageous.
And Mr. Justice Peter Kelly is right. It is outrageous.
Why do you do it?
No, we don't do it. It's the HSE or the employer. We have nothing to do with that. People are put on the specialist register if they have the appropriate qualifications and not if they're not. All we do is maintain that register. It's the employer who has to make sure that these doctors are on the specialist register.
Do you not have to check on the qualifications of those that are on your register?
We do check on them, but we don't employ them. We don't know. We have a specialist register which was created in 2008, and we have a general register in which anybody can go. Anybody who has a medical qualification and completed their internship can be put on.
So a GP could refer you to somebody and you haven't a clue if this person is qualified or not?
Well, you can look them up on the register. But it's wrong. It's wrong that specialists, non-specialists are being appointed in specialist situations. But that's also to do with us not having enough of our own doctors here at home.
And you say that you are completely powerless and that we should all collectively remain powerless on doing any deal to say if we give you a fine education, we expect something back.
I think we could accept something back if the conditions were normal. They're not normal. Our health service is not a crisis waiting to happen. It's in crisis. It's the worst I've ever known in 35 years.
How do patients look up the register?
Well, just the Medical Council website.
And there it is. I'm watching. I have a lot of calls coming in, but I want to come to two stories that are in the paper today. One saying that the HSE managers will be offered voluntary redundancy as part of regional reforms. And the other is the communication from the children's new, soon to be opened, next week to be opened, specialist unit out in Connolly Hospital. And as you read how not prepared it is, it's very hard to keep your spirits up. And I'm very conscious that there are people listening who care passionately about all this, who are working themselves into the ground, who are very committed. And here we have another fine mess.
Yeah, I mean, I really have nothing to say about what the HSE managers, because they're not under my jurisdiction.
But you'd have a view.
Well, I hope they don't make the same mistakes as they made the last time.
Which was?
No redundancies. Okay.
But that was at the setting up of the
HSE.
When all managers all the health from boards,
all the health boards, there was no redundancies. I would have a view that that was the wrong thing to do. I would have a very strong view about the paediatric consultants. Our ethical guide, this is our ethical guide. It's under my pillow these days, okay? Our ethical guide says that doctors have a moral and an ethical responsibility to speak out when conditions for patients are not right. These doctors have, in my opinion, exercised that ethical obligation. I think if they hadn't spoken out, I would be worried about it, okay? So I would support them. If they feel that the conditions in the new unit at Connolly are not safe, then they should not support it. I would feel very strongly about that. Also, I am absolutely know that the public are out there wanting this access. And I would say to you as a GP, I want this access for my patients, but it's the access that is the problem. When you get into the system, by and large, it is superb. It is getting into the system.
Well, it's largely, but largely. Sometimes people get completely carried away as if, you know, there weren't any problems within the system, because there are.
There are, and a lot of it is due to overworked, understaffed units. A lot of that. But by and large, the access is the biggest problem. I mean, this week, I have a patient myself personally since this is where we're the end of July. Last April, I started looking for an appointment for him, okay? And he got sicker. And I sent a second letter. And he got sicker again. He paid out of his own pocket to have something done by another specialist. I wrote a personal letter to two consultants last week. There is no point in sending this man to A&E. The expertise is not there. He needs two separate consultant expertise. It's outside my expertise. And I am tearing my hair out, Marion. This is my patient. I care about him.
Okay. Okay, we're going to take a pause there. If you would stay with us over the Angelus and the news, because there are questions coming in that I want to put to you for the listeners. But now we will pause for the Angelus. Now, thank you very much indeed for that. And we are still on the subject of health and the Irish Medical Council and what is happening, and a couple of calls. Caller says, a GP gets €9 per month for each medical card patient, whether they see them or not.
Oh, there's a very different range. I mean, that's not medical council business, that's GP business on HSE. There are different rates for different ages. I couldn't tell you what the brackets are, but you could see, I mean, I have patients who you might see 40 times a year for €9 a month. That wouldn't be very equitable. So it's a capitation system. That's what it is.
Marion, can you ask your GP guest how many young graduates, here we go again, are going abroad just for better conditions, or is it to do with opportunity and developing skills? Also, how many emigrating graduates are actually returning to their home countries? That's three questions in one.
In one.
Yeah.
I can't give you the exact figures, but they're going away for better conditions. They're going away for better, or rather to look at what the deficits here that are making them going. It's the working conditions, it's actually terms and conditions. I mean, I have to be honest about it, the salary thing is another issue, but it's career progression as well. There's no career pathways for these people.
Why not?
Because there should be.
But why not?
Well, the NDTP are doing some work on that. I suppose
NGPP, who's that?
Sorry, NDTP, the National Doctor Training and Planning within the HSE. And that's recently been chaired by Professor Frank Murray from the RCPI. And they are looking at this, at the career progression. If, for example, you're a hospital doctor and you do all your training and you're qualified specialist or you're a surgeon, whatever, and then you work 10 years at the coalface, in my head, maybe that's the time to stop and maybe take more look at what you've learnt in those 10 years and start to innovate and do things differently. Reflection and change. So as that it's not when you get that job at age 34 or 35, when you've finished all your qualifications, that's it for life. There needs to be progression and changes and teaching and learning and all of that.
Yeah, you were saying that if we got the 519 consultants that were short, that we still wouldn't have enough.
That's right. We still, if as I said, the HSE figures as of the end of June was 519 consultant posts vacant, okay? If we got those 519, God, wouldn't it be wonderful? But we still would have the lowest number of consultants within the OECD.
Okay, the next question was, or is it to do, well, you answered that one. Also, how many emigrating students are actually returning to their home countries?
Do you mean going back to Malaysia?
That sort of thing, yeah.
Well, they're not getting their internship here, so they're going back very young. Just as soon as they finish their education, they return to their home countries.
Right. Yeah. Marion, my son is an intern in a Dublin hospital. He's working 90 plus hours a week, getting 5 to 6 hours sleep a night. I would encourage him to emigrate.
Yeah, I can understand that. That is illegal. The HSE are in breach of the legislation when that happens. I have written to the HSE only within the last 3 weeks to say, look, we're getting reports about this. You must implement the legislation.
Well, looking up the attendant stuff in the brief, I mean, the things that can bring adverse outcomes, being bullied leads
Absolutely.
To further adverse outcomes.
Or people who have been involved in an adverse outcome, often their defences drop and they can be easier bullied as a result of the adverse outcome.
So bullying, tiredness does it.
Listen, I remember my intern year. It's ingrained. I can still remember the patients, some of the patients. I can still remember some of my experiences that would have had an indelible effect on my life. I have a huge interest in doctor well-being. And we have a health committee within the council and we support doctors who have illness to stay on the register or to get back on the register. So doctors are like anybody else. They're human. They get sick. They get the same illnesses as everybody else and they need to be supported. But they get burnt out. They get exhausted and they just want to go to fresher fields. And I absolutely agree. If that was my son, I wouldn't blame him.
No. And I have to say that thinking of the patient, I would hate to be the patient that this son approached after he had done 88 hours work.
Oh, absolutely. I remember, though, Marion, going back within my own profession, we used to have our own local rotas before co-ops came on. And it was my duty, always Tuesday night was my duty. And I actually used to take Tuesday afternoon and go to bed for the afternoon because I would be working all night and expected to work all of Wednesday as well. So it was very difficult in those days. But demands are different now. Patients are living longer. They have more complex problems as a result and higher expectations. And I accept that that's a reasonable thing to have.
Well, we want people to live longer and to live
a
good
healthy
quality
life.
Lives.
Yes.
Yeah. But I mean, how do you stop that? That's ridiculous. 90 plus hours per week.
Well, that's wrong. It's morally wrong, but it's also illegal. And somebody has to take a case against the HSE for this.
Yes, but if he takes a case against the HSE,
well, maybe the training bodies can
trouble.
Do it. Okay, there are training bodies for the various branches of the profession. Maybe the training bodies, maybe the medical council would, but that's would be a nuclear option for us. We don't want to be fighting with the HSE, but I'm continually reminding that this is against the law.
Right. Bravo, says another caller, for raising the issue of bullying in the Irish medical system. Please don't overlook very, in capitals, that wouldn't go down with Rees-Mogg either, but never mind, very significant, widespread and insidious bullying by HSE management.
I don't have experience of it. I do hear about it. And we haven't, to my knowledge, had a complaint about it. But I certainly know of a situation where two separate consultants told me that a HSE manager had said to them that they'd make a spurious complaint to the medical council if they didn't keep their mouths shut. And I said, if you keep your mouth shut, I'll be making a complaint. Okay.
Well, on the question of keeping your mouth shut, I remember a controversy over one of the contracts, I can't remember which one, where doctors, I can't remember, was it consultants or GPs or who were they, were not allowed to articulate advocacy for patients?
Advocacy is a very important role for doctors. Let me state that very clearly. It's in our ethical guide. Doctors must be advocates for their patients. Patients are wonderful advocates. We've had wonderful experience with Vicky Phelan and Lorraine.
Yeah, but look what they had to go through.
Absolutely.
I mean, in the middle of all their worries and their concern, and they're going through this to help other people, that's what we expect from the professionals.
Yes, we do expect from the profession, and that's what they're doing. That's what these paediatricians have done this week. And if doctors are not advocating for their patients, I would be considering them less than professional, let's put it that way.
And, I mean, the HSE, clearly they get very... I don't know which they we're talking about now. I presume non-medical people. I mean, they get cross at criticism. And are they the ones that would say to your two consultants, if you open your beak criticising us, we will report you to the medical council?
And I think what they said was they would make a spurious complaint about them to the medical council. Okay,
yeah.
And look, as I said to you, every currently under the legislation, every complaint has to be answered. Look, there are very good people in the HSE, don't get me wrong, but there are people who are not as professional as they should be.
And defensive, it would seem.
The HSE?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And yes, there was. It was the GP contract that there were, the under sixes contract that there was a suggested gagging clause in.
Yeah.
And no GP would ever sign a contract that had a gagging clause.
Okay. Marion, as a hard pressed taxpayer and a parent to three children who are unable to do medicine but themselves are taxpayers, I believe we should not be educating students in medicine who do not wish to work here. Back on that one?
Well, you know, the graduates are international graduates. They pay very big money. They help to fund the universities. Do you look a gift horse in the mouth?
3,000 registered GPs, 1,500 full-time equivalents, 90% complained spurious. A complaint uses 100 hours of GP time. Complaints result in mental illness for doctors and are associated with suicide. And that comes from a former GP.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have the statistics on suicide. We do have them in the UK, and certainly the GMC would be worried that their complaints process would lead to an increase in the incidence of suicide amongst doctors. The spurious complaints bit, as I said, it is the law now that any complaint must be opened. We have been looking for this amendment to the legislation for 9 years now. Hopefully this December we'll see it through.
Okay. Another caller in here. Now, I've heard this articulated quite a few times, and it's a very delicate thing because one doesn't want to be in any way racist. But language is the biggest problem with international medical professions in my experience, Marion. And it is true. I mean, what do you do to try and get somebody to a level of English that everybody can understand? After you've said, pardon me, or excuse me, or what did you say, like three times,
yeah,
it's getting very embarrassing and you don't like to be rude to somebody. But if you're the one lying in the bed with whatever the heck is wrong with you, you need to be able to understand what's being said to you.
You absolutely do. But every doctor who's practicing in this country has passed an internationally recognised English language test.
But you know that.
I absolutely. And sometimes
you know that they're extremely hard to understand.
Sometimes. Yeah. Okay. And sometimes it's the intonation or the accent that is the problem. They have the proper English, but they accent it differently to how we do. But I think that if you don't understand, you need to say, look, I actually don't understand. Will you slow down? And I really want to hear what you say. I know.
Well,
I know,
you know, if you're an elderly person.
Yes.
You're feeling vulnerable.
Yes.
Somebody comes in and speaks out loud to you very quickly and tells you that, and they're gone.
Yeah, I know. I know. I was an inpatient recently myself, and times have changed. In my day, you did a round with the consultant, and then you, as the junior doctor, went back to explain to the patient what was happening. Okay, they're so busy these days. I see them running. The junior doctor's job is holding the computer, and of course, you need to be aware that the computer is a block to communications, but we're back to the communications training, and it's going to be mandatory. So that will address some of those deficiencies.
And somebody else in a consultant was telling me recently, was in an A&E, that there was nobody nursing. They were all sitting with their backs to the trolleys, essentially, looking at computer screens. Like,
yeah, it's times have changed. But having said that, I have spent two separate occasions in A&E recently, and those nurses and health professionals were working non-stop, and they were caring for their patients.
Okay. Marion, this is a similar thing. Some have very poor communication skills and no empathy, which can be very damaging for patients. And this caller says, speaking from experience, can you teach empathy?
Can you teach professionalism? Empathy is part of
professionalism. You can teach professionalism.
Yeah, but empathy is part of it. Very few doctors are non-empathetic, but if you meet one, oh my goodness, they're probably in the wrong branch of the profession. If they're dealing with patients and have no empathy, they maybe need to become pathologists or something like that. So, you know,
all pathologists.
Yes, pathologists talk to slides, okay, as opposed to patients. We have a lovely two pathologists on the medical council who are superb, and I tease them about that they're talking to the slides down the microscope. They would have less need to communicate with empathy to patients, okay? There's a good balance there. You can teach a bit of it, but it's all part of communication as well.
Yeah, and I suppose they don't listen. But I had experience of children's hospitals, and I arrived at the conclusion that the children were treated like adults, where adults in hospital are treated like children.
It's good. It's a good
spoken down to, because kids can see through that straight away.
But I think that you probably know about the campaign "Hello, My Name Is," and I actually think that if a health professional comes in and says "Hello, my name is Rita" or "My name is Dr. Rita" or whatever, I think that starts the breakdown. Okay, and they stop talking to them as children. I think the above down approach is gone. I actually think equality exists.
Well, then why do you say there's so much bullying?
Well, I'm talking about doctor and patient.
Oh, right.
Was talking about the doctor-patient relationship there. Okay.
Many of the... The doctors should be charged the full economic cost of their training.
Well, that's for the government to decide, okay? I had to pay for my training when I went through, and then free education came later. So that's a Department of Health decision. It's not anything to do with what we do.
Though you hear hair-raising stories in America of people coming out of college and they've got like heaps of debt on their back that's going to go on forever. But anyway, a lot of people, there's another caller saying, should be forced to stay in the country until they have paid back to the state, or else let them pay for their own training.
Forced to stay at a 90-hour week? I wouldn't agree with that.
Why, oh why, does it take the medical council so long to handle a complaint about a doctor? I was 3 years waiting on a medical council hearing. Your guest speaks of pulling her hair out. I have suffered terribly in the 3 years it took, and also I believe the medical council is for doctors, not for the public. Like me, ask her how she intends to handle complaints going forward. That's banned by Rees-Mogg as well, by the way, just to let you know. In the future, shall we say. And sorry, I don't mean to be in the least bit
facetious,
you know, laughing about this. you know, there you go.
Yeah.
3 years.
Yeah.
Why does it take 3 years?
It doesn't always take 3 years. That's an exception. That's honest, okay? I would be given out to now for what I'd say. A part of this is the legal side of things, okay? When a complaint comes in and it's opened, it is shared then openly with the doctor and the complainant, okay? And the doctor is advised to contact their own indemnifier.
Insurer.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So the indemnifier may, the insurer may well advise them to take a deep breath and wait to get some advice before they respond to the complaint. And at times, simple complaints with a very quick answer would close at a much quicker speed.
But well, the amount of stories we heard around the time of cervical check, and we heard them from consultants, we heard them from doctors, we heard them from patients, that if something has gone wrong, that the evidence is there that all people really want to know. There will always be exceptions.
Yeah.
What they want to know is what happened,
yeah.
Why did it happen, and an apology.
Absolutely, and we talked about that earlier.
But you see the indemnifiers
on.
Say no, no, no.
Well, I think the new open disclosure legislation will deal with that.
Now, come back to this person. I don't know if it's a man or a woman. 3 years. That's 3 years. Yeah. With something hanging over.
And I'm not clear from what you're saying, whether this is a patient, the patient with the complaint, or whether it's the doctor.
No, it's the doctor.
Is it?
Yeah. And she maintains that the medical council should be for doctors, not for the public.
The medical council...
Oh, hold on, I've got that wrong. Also, I believe the medical council is for doctors, not for the public like me. Sorry, I misunderstood that when I was reading it out. This is a complaint from a patient.
Yeah, and you know...
Well, it's the same question. Why does it take so long?
It doesn't always. That's an exception. That is an exception. I don't have the stats on how long, but we continuously are reviewing how long things take and trying to improve upon them. And sometimes it's getting expertise from abroad, that type of thing that we can't get home experts because doctors won't give expert against their own colleagues. That type of thing, or there may be conflicts of interest. But get this really clear. The medical council is there for patient safety. Part of patient safety is managing the professional qualifications of the profession and supporting the profession in doing their best. So it's not for one or the other.
That's a tricky one.
Mm. And
that's
a
very tricky one.
It's a very tricky one. And we would say, you know, talking about these doctors, the paediatricians, we would say that if there is an issue with patients, your responsibility to your patient comes before your responsibility to your employer. And this is what has happened with these doctors.
Okay, another caller. My daughter is trained 3 years and is on the GP training scheme. In 3 years and in several hospitals, she worked 100 hours plus weekly. Her 24-hour shifts were sometimes 26 hours. This is scandalous.
It is scandalous, but this is the HSE responsibility. And we keep bringing it to them.
And then when you talk to the HSE, they say, oh, it's the Department of Health's responsibility.
No, it is. They're the employer. The HSE is the employer. Employment conditions are the responsibility of the employer.
Well, again, may I say, I would absolutely hate to meet a doctor if I had something seriously wrong with me after they were on duty for 100 hours. That's torture that's used to disorient prisoners.
Absolutely agree with you.
Right. Marion, I spent 9 hours in A&E last night. A 79-year-old woman sat in a chair for 13 hours before I left. She was in pain, waiting to see a doctor. I heard so many staff apologising to patients for the wait. And yes, I had excellent treatment from an Egyptian registrar who's only been here 2 years. Also, I'd say 20% of the patients were there. Well, now, this is another issue due to drug and alcohol issues. And that annoys people as well, because if you take the 79-year-old woman, isn't that terrible?
It is absolutely. So indefensible. Is it indefensible?
Well,
it is indefensible.
But it's so frustrating. You don't want this to happen. You know, the HSE doesn't want this to happen. The Department of Health doesn't want this to happen. GPs don't want it to happen. Consultants don't want it. Why does everybody go around as if they're helpless? Like, it has to be resolved.
It absolutely has to. Let me tell you a good story, OK? You know that I work out in Bray in County Wicklow, OK? And there was a bit of kerfuffle when the A&E department in our local hospital, Columbkills in Loughlinstown, was closed, OK? But my goodness, that was the best thing that ever happened. We have a fabulous medical assessment unit there and a limb injury unit. We have a HSE manager who has a can-do attitude. So when my elder lemons or my older patients need to go to hospital, they'll say, please send me to Loughlinstown. And they are seen. There is no waiting time. I'm afraid to say this publicly in case it gets bogged down.
There is very little waiting time.
They're extraordinarily well looked after and back home or to their nursing home as quickly as possible. And it is fantastic. So there are other ways of doing things.
Well, the point was made about Roscommon Hospital, was made on the programme last week, that there was Míle Murder when it was closed down, but then now it's doing wonderful work.
Yeah, and I suppose I used to always say that medicine should be, or healthcare should be, outside politics. And I was told I was a lunatic. You can't close a hospital if there's a general election coming up.
I know. But just to come back to your elderly patients, I gather they beg not to go to A&E.
They absolutely beg not to go to A&E. I look after a 90-bed nursing home and I get a wonderful service for my elderly patients. And, you know, I can get them 24 hours even, might get them over the little hump and back to my care. And that is the way we should go forward. But the new organisation of the health service, the Sláinte Care, it's the only show on the road. We have to invest in it.
Okay. Okay, listen, thank you very, very much indeed. It must be, and I repeat this because I'm giving out so much, or articulating other people giving out, and I know people work so hard in the service, but it's got to be resolved.
It has to be resolved.
Okay. Okay, we'll take a break there. And thank you very, very much indeed for talking to us.
You're very welcome.